What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, producer of 411 Teen. In September 2009, 18-year-old Lawson Mayfield's life was cut short after she contracted bacterial meningitis. According to the National Meningitis Association, bacterial meningitis strikes an average of 1,500 Americans annually, with 1 in 7 cases proving fatal and another 20% of victims suffering serious long-term consequences. Lawson's parents, Kathy and Emery Mayfield, established the Lawson Mayfield Memorial Foundation to benefit the National Meningitis Association and increase the awareness of the disease. The foundation will host its third annual Run for Lawson, September 28, 2013, at Holy Comforter Episcopal School. A special welcome to Dr. Tamika Funny. She is a practice at Southern Eastern Center for Infectious Disease. So I want to welcome both of you to 411 Teen. Let's start with you, Kathy. Can you tell us and share with us about the foundation?
Certainly. First, I'd like to thank you so much for having us here again. We started the foundation after Lawson's death in 2010 because we knew nothing about bacterial meningitis when Lawson contracted it and then subsequently died. And it was such a life-altering event that we just really wanted other people, other families, other teens, young adults, and other parents to benefit from our tragedy so that maybe we could help someone else and maybe we could keep that from happening to someone else's family.
Okay.
Lawson died. She contracted bacterial meningitis on a Monday evening and died on Wednesday afternoon. So it was really, really quick. And it was just shocking.
I'm sure. That is just devastating to have it move so quickly. Now, is that normal, Dr. Funny, or what happens there? Will you share with us?
Yes, first I'd like to say thank you guys for having me here and having me.
Oh, thanks for coming.
Oh, not a problem. I love always sharing some information that will help the community, so it's my pleasure. But, yes, very common for bacterial meningitis. It happens very quickly. The symptoms come on very quickly. And usually they have symptoms for only sometimes hours before they become very, very ill. And they present to the hospital. And, yes, death can be very quick. So that is very common.
Well, what is meningitis?
Well, meningitis is an infection of the tissue and the fluid that surrounds the brain and the spinal cord. And you get the bacteria, which is for bacterial meningitis, within that space. So it totally disrupts your mental status, gives you great headaches, fevers. Sometimes they say nuchal rigidity, which means only means a stiff neck.
Mm-hmm.
And it interacts or affects the neural system.
It's interesting when you're talking about those symptoms. In our case, Lawson had 3 or 4 migraine headaches in the last 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't think a lot about the fact that she had a headache. And she was an avid equestrian, so she had been traveling. She'd been in Germany with her mm-hmm. family, her sister, and she came home. She was tired. She had ridden 5 horses mm-hmm. this Monday, and mm-hmm. we were having dinner, and she just said, "I don't feel well. I have a terrible headache." And I didn't really think a lot about it because she'd had them before, and I knew mm-hmm. she was exhausted, and I knew she'd, you know, been – I knew she'd had a long day, and no fever, nothing else but the headache. But the headache was excruciating. And a couple of hours later, I went up to check on her, and I said, something doesn't feel right here. Let's go to the hospital. And she didn't argue with me. And when she didn't argue with me, I said, okay. And that was about 8 o'clock on Monday evening, and they diagnosed bacterial meningitis at about 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, that's is very typical. And as you say, sometimes patients or when they have headaches, and they commonly have headaches, they might not think anything's wrong because that's what it feels like. It feels like a migraine headache. But sometimes they say, you know what, this migraine, it's just a very bad migraine. Might be the only thing they might tell you. Might say, just it doesn't feel like my typical migraine, but you know what, it's just a headache that I always have. And, you know, that time is so critical because bacterial meningitis is very devastating and, you know, a lot of people don't survive it. So that time crunch is the problem that we have because the symptoms are very, they can be very blasé. It can be a common cold. It can be a flu. It can be migraines. You just don't know you have bacterial meningitis. It's not the classic all the time where people say you get a rash or you get the stiff neck and you get the bizarre behavior. It doesn't always show up that way. So it is difficult for parents and children and adults to know what's really going on.
Now, meningitis can be bacterial. It can be viral. And fungal. Will you talk about the others? I know they are probably are not as common, but just for the listening audience and the purpose of information and education, would you share and make those distinctions, please?
Oh, yes, definitely. Well, bacterial meningitis is usually three different types of bacteria that's in the forefront. You have pneumococcal meningitis. You have Neisseria meningitis, meningitis, and you also have Haemophilus meningitis. And then you have viral, which is very common, the enterovirus, which is just a type of a virus that comes on in the summer and the fall. And then you have herpes virus, which is also very common to cause meningitis. And you also have these as more of aseptic. It goes in the categories of aseptic meningitis because it's not bacterial. That's all that means. And even tick-borne illnesses can give you type of you could get Lyme disease, which can interact with the central nervous system and give you same type of headaches and fevers and bizarre behaviors. And also you have fungal. Fungal is very rare. It doesn't really hit as many normal what we call immunocompetent, meaning patients who have their immune system is very intact. They typically don't get fungal meningitis. Patients with a compromised immune system, they more fall to fungal meningitis. They are on chronic steroids or they have any type of anything that will affect their immune system. And cryptococcal is a type of fungal meningitis. And as an infectious disease specialist, of course, we see them all, but it's really not that common in the community.
Let's see. Do the symptoms vary with age? I mean, because we're talking about, you know, a teenager. What about with the young ones? Are the elderly or just older? Do you see the same kind?
It's the same type of symptoms. You definitely get fevers, headaches, mental status change. So when we say mental status change, they're just not acting the same. They might be a little lethargic. You can't really wake them up. They're not their bubbly self. They're not coming down for dinner or they're doing things that they wouldn't normally do. They're putting a box of cereal in the refrigerator instead of in the cupboard. And they're, you know, it's something that, well, okay, you're acting strange. And children have the same type of symptoms because it affects the brain the same way. So the symptoms are the same, but they vary. Some could just have one and some could have all. But they are the same.
Did you see any, even though it was such a short period of time, Kathy, did you see?
We did. I will say that along with the headache, she was very lethargic. And that's when I thought, oh, we've got, you know, this is a problem. And one thing that I would say, when I went to the emergency room, I, of course, immediately told the doctors that she'd had migraines before and she had medication for it, but she had thrown up the medication. She also was nauseated, but that was typical with a migraine. But I would say now, and I've told all of my friends and our family and everybody that if you've got anything that looks like a severe flu, a severe cold, whatever, tell them to check for meningitis. Some places or some medical facilities are keyed into it, and they automatically do it, and that's the first thing they talk about it. Some aren't. And through my work with the National Meningitis Association, I found out that many times some of the cases where the problems were, where the healthcare professionals just didn't know about meningitis, didn't know to automatically check for it. And, you know, that so they didn't check maybe till 24 or 48 hours later, and it was devastating.
Well, what I find, you know, just really just so confusing is you can think you have the flu.
Absolutely.
Or just, yes. You know, the sniffles.
That's right.
Or you have – so how does one determine? What do you do? I mean, because at what point – do you go, I must go to the doctor? Because, you know, we all have symptoms that are quite common, and we think, it'll go away. Mm-hmm. But what I hear from you, Dr. Funny, is we need to jump on this immediately.
Oh,
but what happened is everybody would be running to the to the doctor all the time.
Well, I think with the flu or the common cold, there's a little bit of the main thing is the severity of everything.
Okay.
And that's the difference.
It's not quite so debilitating.
Exactly. Yeah. The symptoms are the same, yes, but the severity of it, this isn't my typical headache. This isn't your typical lethargy or tiredness or fatigue for those, for clarification. You're not normally in bed and can't be aroused, can't really wake. When you have the flu, yes, you feel horrible. Mm-hmm. You feel pretty much as bad that you can also request to go to the hospital with the flu.
That's true.
Because it also puts you out for the count, wipes you out. So really, when you're not sure and you do feel that ill, the best thing is to go to the ER, to go to the hospital and have them sort it out. Mm-hmm. Have the infectious disease specialist sort it out. Have the ER physician say, okay, let me do a lumbar puncture, which is what we do for meningitis. That's how we are able to diagnose it. We do put a little needle in the back. We withdraw fluid, and we analyze that fluid. So it's always best to check, to
and
be safe.
And that's very common, is it not?
Very
common. And very safe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very common, very safe. That's the standard, gold standard to diagnose meningitis. So, you know, never be scared to go to the hospital and get clarification because, okay, it's great. You don't have meningitis. You have the flu.
Is it common that they will always check for meningitis since it presents, you know, like the flu, and they can have patients coming in complaining about the flu or complaining about a headache? Is that a common procedure that the ER physician will automatically check for meningitis? And I guess my question on top of that is that what happened, or did you have to insist?
I didn't have to insist, but we talked about it, and they waited. Like I say, we got there about 8:30 or 9 o'clock, and we didn't do the actual test till about 3 o'clock in the morning because we thought it was a migraine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it may have been a little earlier than that, and we actually got the results back about 3, so he may have done it at 1:30 or so. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the exact time frame. But there again, you know, knowledge is power. If I had to do it over or if I had a grandchild now that I had any – at any question at all, I would immediately mention it to wherever the healthcare professional or wherever you were in the emergency room. And I think a lot of them are keyed into it, but there again, sometimes they think it's the flu, you know?
And you're right. It's not always like the first thing they jump to, and especially depends on the season. Flu season is going to be very complicated, very complex, and the symptoms are going to cross, and they might not automatically jump to do a lumbar puncture. It's flu season. You have the symptoms of the flu. But, you know, as you say, knowledge is power. If a parent or a child, they hear about this broadcast and they say, you know what, we had a friend that had meningitis or had a niece that had meningitis, they might more prompt or push
absolutely
the physician to look for that. And sometimes you do need a little push. And, you know, I can't say it's very common to give everyone a lumbar puncture. No, it's not, because it comes with some risk. But is it uncommon? No. And you'll find a lot of hospitals who are keen to have a lot of children in the area, FSU and FAMU, and they have colleges, TCC. They're going to more probably look for that in that type of community because of the close quarters and things of that nature.
Okay. Kathy, this will be the third annual run. Tell us where, when, again.
Oh, I'm happy to.
Okay.
We are having our Run for Lawson, a 5K, 10K, and a 1-mile fun walk run on Saturday, September 28th of this year. It's at Holy Comforter Episcopal School on Fleischman Road. I think it's 1500 Fleischman Road. Mm-hmm. And we will start at 8 o'clock in the morning. Excuse me, it's 2001 Fleischman Road.
Okay.
We'll start at 8 o'clock with our 1 mile and 8:30 with the 5 and the 10K. We'd love – everybody can pre-register online at runforlawson.org, or you can come out Thursday and Friday to Gold's Gym North and register, mm-hmm. or even the Saturday, the morning of the run.
Okay. And how many participants do you anticipate?
Oh, we're excited. Last year we had – over 750
so
runners.
Each year it's getting
it's
more
getting
because
huge.
The year before that
That's
it was
right.
about 600.
Absolutely.
And you, I think you, and 35,000 the year before that.
Yeah. So both years we've been able to contribute $35,000 to the National Meningitis Association.
Oh, that's great.
And this year we're really trying to emphasize the booster shots, which we'll get Dr. Funny to talk
yes.
about. But all of our children in Leon County are required with the school system to have the meningococcal vaccination going into the 7th grade. And the CDC recommends that they also have a booster shot between the ages of 16 and 18.
Okay.
So I'd like for Dr. Funny to
And we'll get right
that.
Back to it. You're tuned in to 411 Team. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and it's a very informational program this day. This is the third time that we are having the annual Run for Lawson. It's September 28, 2013, at Holy Comforter Episcopal School. We have been talking about bacterial meningitis. And before we went on break, well, during the break, we were talking about all the booster shot. And I'm going to go to you, Dr. Funny, and have you just talk about the booster shot and the vaccination and what are the indications and all of that, if you will.
Yeah, well, right now they are recommending that adolescents between 11 and 18 get the meningococcal vaccine. And now they're also saying, like, after about 5 years or so, they recommend a booster shot for – there's still some research that they're not sure if the immunity lasts. So in order to prepare these adolescents that get it at age 11 or 12 going into college, they recommend that the booster shot be given to get them prepared for that close dormitory environment, in which that's where meningococcal meningitis is very common and that has shown that the vaccine has reduced that risk. And they're also saying for a lot of returning adults going back to school, because now we have a lot of older adults going back to college to further their college education, and they're of age 24 or 25 or even older. And they're saying if you haven't received that shot in the last 5 years, they're now actually requiring you to get that shot, also the booster, the vaccine. If you just don't have any records and you're not sure if you've received the shot, they want you to get the shot once again, the booster.
Would you identify the conditions that make you a high risk and that really indicate you need to get that immunization?
Well, definitely adolescents, they're all already recommending between that age.
Mm-hmm.
So adolescents going into school. And also, the pneumococcal vaccine, since 2000, they've all babies are now that's within their record, mm-hmm. within their shot recommendations and requirements is the pneumococcal vaccine. And they also get the Hib mm-hmm. vaccine that's also now. And these have all shown that it's decreased the effects of pneumococcal meningitis, pneumococcal disease, and also the meningococcal vaccination for younger kids and adolescents. But if you have the risk factors of having any type of brain injury or insult, shunt, or any type of physical condition that puts you at risk for meningitis, they recommend you get the vaccination also.
Okay. And I think they also, don't they say that the college dormitory is just the closeness of everybody,
yes.
the yes. lack of sleep, and
yes.
that the bacteria is very contagious, and it's passed with respiratory, like sneezing, coughing, mm-hmm. kissing,
mm-hmm. sharing,
and
that utensils,
sharing utensils,
cigarettes,
mm-hmm. and sharing drinks and everything. So that's why they highly recommend it for the
yes.
for the kids going to college.
So really what we're saying is what happens with bacterial infections, like it affects the membranes, and then, you know, the membranes, I guess, around the brain and around the spinal cord, causing inflammation. But this bacteria can come from any place, right?
Yes.
If I have an understanding, I mean, it could be from an ear infection or
yes.
a strep throat
yes.
or sore throat or whatever.
Yes. Because when we have the strep pneumonia, you can just have transient bacteria that's
mm-hmm.
in your body
mm-hmm.
that it crosses the blood-brain barrier, and that's how you get it. That's how you get meningitis.
Mm-hmm.
You can have an earache, a bad earache, or just any type of cold, a bronchitis, and you have a pneumococcal bronchitis, and then this is in the blood. And normally you will clear it, but sometimes you don't, and it passes the blood-brain barrier, and that's how it gets into the brain.
Well, is there any point that or anyone that doesn't need to get the vaccine?
Well, we wouldn't say that does it. Definitely adolescents,
mm-hmm.
definitely military workers, definitely patients who work with animals. It is recommended. And also older individuals greater than 65, they get the pneumococcal vaccine. And actually travelers, a lot of people traveling to sub-Saharan Africa, they also need the meningitis because there's a meningitis belt there that they recommend if you're traveling to that area. So right now, that is the recommendation. It's not universal for everyone at this point, but it doesn't hurt
mm-hmm.
to get if you are concerned of your risk factors. And also if you have any type of, as I said, any type of CNS disorder
mm-hmm.
that puts you at risk.
I know we had a meeting recently with the National Meningitis Association, and a doctor from the CDC was there. And he mentioned that a lot of times when you're wondering why you should or why you shouldn't,
mm-hmm.
and if it's recommended or it's not, it's a pure numbers situation to where it won't hurt you, but it's not recommended necessarily because there aren't that many cases. It's
mm-hmm.
rare.
Mm-hmm.
And so since it's so rare, that's where they get into the situation of when they recommend it. And so Leon County Health Department offers the meningococcal vaccine free to anyone 18 years or younger.
Say that again.
Free. Leon County Health Department offers
That's
it free.
Important.
I've spoken with them several times in the last several years.
That's great.
And they will give anyone a booster, the regular vaccination, and it is free to anyone who's 18 or younger.
Okay. So basically healthy people can be carrying bacteria
yes.
in their nose or in their throat. And this bacteria, you know, can run amok.
Yes, exactly right.
I got it.
You got it.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
And that's what happens.
Yes.
Okay. I know we're talking about bacterial meningitis, but I'd also like to have you address viral meningitis, okay? Because I guess with viral meningitis, I would think it would basically have to run its course.
Yes.
Yeah, because if it's a viral meningitis, I mean, I guess you can treat the symptoms,
well,
but
there are two. The one that just has to run its course is more of the enterovirus.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're referring to. That's a virus that we all have. We can get in between the summer and fall months. Very common, and you need more what would they call supportive measures. So you need fluids, you need Tylenol for aches and pains, but yes, there is no treatment for it because it is a virus.
Mm-hmm.
And that it can actually take sometimes weeks for the patient to feel well. They get very dehydrated, so it's just for them to kind of relax and get supportive treatment. But then there's the herpes virus, which also causes meningitis, causes terrible headaches, can also even lead to seizures. And also it's very important because you have very bad neurological consequences from the herpes virus.
I'll share those.
And you can have like stroke-like symptoms in which, you know, because it kind of affects one side of the brain. So you can have what we call the consequences of just having some weakness or residual deficits. And with the herpes virus, there is treatment, and you have to be started on a type of antiviral acyclovir in order to treat you. That's not supportive measures. You have to get treatment for that.
Now, are those symptoms the same? Are they typical too?
They are typical.
They can diagnose that.
Oh, yes. With a lumbar puncture, a spinal tap. Okay. And we actually, with the fluid that they remove from with the spinal tap, they actually check it for herpes virus, herpes simplex virus, type 1 or type 2. And we all know herpes virus can lay dormant in your body for years on end, and then you have meningitis from it. And it causes to have bizarre behaviors also, headaches, photophobia, which is light, light sensitivity. So it presents almost the same way. So that's why you have to test with the lumbar puncture, and you have to run the fluid. Because sometimes when we don't know what type of meningitis a patient will have, we will start them on what we call empiric treatment. Okay. We will start them on antibacterial medication, just in case it's bacterial meningitis, and we will start them on antiviral medication in case it's viral meningitis. But the information usually comes back fairly quickly, and we can de-escalate therapy and just put them on what they need to be on.
Now, are there cases where there may be, what would I say, non-infectious causes of meningitis? I mean, I'm just thinking, what about allergies and cancer and lupus?
That wouldn't be really considered meningitis. Is more of a, you know, it can be irritation or encephalitis. But, you know, like different, it could be mass or something in the brain itself that's causing them to be act bizarre. But these things can also be picked up with a CAT scan to really look at the brain itself to see what's really going on. But sometimes, even trauma, and you can get a little bit of white blood cells in the from the spinal fluid secondary to accidents and had pretty much a bad fall. We've had that, and it causes headaches and not feeling well. But when you run the cultures, everything is really negative. And we call that a pleocytosis, which you just have white blood cells within the fluid. But there's not infectious. It's non-infectious. Mm-hmm. But you're right. Metastatic disease and things of that nature, yes, can lead.
Okay. My old microbiology's coming back.
That's right. Always comes in handy.
It comes in handy. Let's talk, and I know you've touched on this, but would you talk a little bit more about the transmission of it? Because I think it's so important that our listening audience pick up on that. You know, to just how is it transmitted? You know, I mean, there are risk factors, and we know. So would you elaborate on that again for the listening audience?
Well, with Neisseria meningitis, the one that's the main one that's important as far as close contact, that's the one that they refer to kissing. It's exchange of saliva, respiratory secretions. And close contact.
Sneezing, close contact.
Yes,
okay.
Close contact, a boyfriend and a girlfriend or a roommate. And even for our ER physicians that are doing intubations because they come in contact with the saliva. But it's very close contact, and even household family members in the household, they are at risk. Daycare kids that are in close contact with each other, that those are the ones we're usually concerned about. And if that does exist, we normally give a prophylaxis medication to those patients in order to make sure it doesn't lead to meningitis. But of course, you can still catch meningitis. But if we give prophylaxis early enough, that will help with stopping the case.
Okay. What about complications that are associated with meningitis? What are they?
You can get neurological deficits, or it's almost as if you had. It looks like you've had a stroke. You can get even seizures, ongoing seizures after that. You can have impairment. It's neurological impairment that you can get from meningitis.
Eyesight and hearing. Mm-hmm. And then amputations are quite common.
Okay.
And a lot of times, even some of the consequences are from the high-dose antibiotics that you have to receive. Because we have, in order to save the patient, you know, they're on very aggressive treatment, very high-dose antibiotics. And sometimes these high doses lead to the hearing loss and the kidney damage and things of that nature. But in order to save a life, you know, those are some of the consequences that, you know, family and patients are willing to take.
Comments?
Well, there again, the listening audience is our target for this bacterial meningitis. And one thing I want to, I'm going to change the subject a little bit and go back to the run, because one thing we're doing this year that we haven't done in the past in trying to get the attention of all the middle school and high schoolers is we're offering, or we are giving a reward, a monetary reward, to the three schools with the top participation.
Wow.
We are going to give the top participating school, and they can be faculty as well as students, $2,000.
Oh.
And we're going to award the second school $1,000 and the third $500. So we're really trying to get everybody's attention, and
we're just trying
to promote it and get the awareness out for the kids. We are lucky. We seem to have, and I don't have the exact figure, but we have a lot of young people in this age group running, which a lot of the 5 and the 10Ks don't. And we have a lot of the high school, the middle school and high school track, cross-country track teams participating.
Okay.
So we're really excited, but that's one thing we're doing this year that we've not done in the past.
That's great.
All right. And tell us about registration.
Okay. Registration is available right now online. You can go to runforlawson.org, and there's just click on the registration page, and you can register with a credit card. You can also online print the registration form and send it in to the address on the form. And then there's not the processing fee that the credit card companies charge us. It's registration will be open. We'll have pre-registration and pre-packet pickup at Gold's Gym North on Thursday and Friday afternoon before the run. So that's the 26th and the 27th from 4 to 7 p.m. If you've already registered, you can come by and pick up your number and everything. If you haven't registered, you can come by and register. We'll also be open at 7 o'clock in the morning for registration and pickup at the site itself of the run.
Okay.
So we're ready to go. We're going
to
cover it.
Well, you're
to
be
commended. Trying to cover all our bases.
Yes,
this is great.
Isn't it great? This is the third year.
Yes.
The third year. I mean, I commend you. I think this is fantastic.
It's very exciting.
It is, isn't it? I want to get back to meningitis, though. And I know you've kind of covered everything, but my concern is for those young parents, those new parents who have young children, because children can't talk.
That's right.
So how do they know? And I know you may not see it as, but in daycare, you mentioned daycare, and I wanted to touch on that. Daycare is an environment where they're interacting a lot. They're, you know, sneezing, coughing, putting everything in their mouth.
That's right.
And it's normal for them to have a runny nose and to have flu-like symptoms. What does a parent do, and when does that parent decide, I need to, seek some professional help?
Well, definitely usually with children, and your pediatrician will also guide you, because new parents are usually, they very much watch over their children like hawks, and they know when something's different. And the child is a little bit more tired. They have fevers, and they're just what we call listless. They're kind of floppy, and, you know, they're not holding on and doing the things that they would normally do. Their strength is a little bit less. They have fevers. They have high fevers.
Okay, so they'll have fevers.
Yes, and meningitis, you can definitely have fevers. And they're not their self. That's usually what we will tell. They're just not acting themselves. And normally in that regard, you would bring them into the hospital. And they will also notify, if meningitis is diagnosed, they will notify parents at the daycare. They'll notify, of course, everyone in the household. And really now with it's so important for these vaccines that are recommended for children for you to go through the age appropriate shots.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because they have the vaccines now, the Hib and the pneumococcal vaccines that really have decreased the amount of meningitis that are usually caused by these organisms.
That made a huge difference.
Almost 64%.
Now, did small children, babies, and that, do they have
the stiffness? Let me ask you to hold your thought, and you can come back with that question. We're going to take a break, but we'll return momentarily. Tuned in to 411 Teen. This hour we are honoring Lawson Mayfield, an amazing young woman whose life was cut short by bacterial meningitis. The Lawson Mayfield Memorial Foundation will hold its third annual benefit in honor of Lawson, who made an indelible mark on everyone who crossed her path. Her sudden passing sent shockwaves through her family, friends, and the entire Tallahassee community. Before we went on break, Kathy, you had a question that you wanted to pose to Dr. Funny, so pose it.
Okay. I was, when we were talking about the symptoms, especially for children and young children, I just wondered, do they have the stiff neck symptoms the same as, you know, an older 11-year-old or 18-year-old or adult?
Oh, great question. And the real when we say stiff neck, it's really the patient themselves. They have a lot of pain. They have a lot of inflammation, and they have much difficulty bending their neck. And also when us as a physician try to manipulate their neck to examine them, they're very resistant.
Okay.
And they don't want you to bend their neck. So it's stiff, or it's hard for us to bend it. And in a child, sometimes when checking that, they'll have pain. They might cry. They might not want to really move their head or their neck like they would normally do. They won't want to tumble and grab on and, you know, really they want to kind of be still because it hurts. And that's always a problem with children and examining children. They can't talk. So you have to look. So what you look for are things that are different. You look for things that they normally don't do. You look for them crying. You look for them actually being very clingy. Maybe they normally want to be on the floor and crawl around and get into things, but instead they want to just hang on to mom. That's something that's different. With mothers and fathers, that's usually what they look for, and that's what they usually see. You know, my child really isn't acting themselves, and that's what you want to. That's the only thing you could really go by with a nonverbal infant.
Are there preventative measures that we can take?
Well, other than the vaccines that are really out there, that's what we kind of key into, and that's what we really push. But your regular normal hand washing and your hygiene and the importance of that is key if you don't have the vaccine. But the vaccine is really what's important.
Okay, all right. And I know you've touched on this, but would you? How definitive is diagnosis?
Well, I mean, you know, whether it's culture or imaging or, you know, spinal tap, I mean, how definitive is it?
Well, the lumbar puncture is, I'd say, the gold standard,
okay.
And you'll see positive cultures, and it will identify the bacteria. But sometimes if the physician is pretty certain clinically and feels that the patient does have bacterial meningitis, and for some reason the lumbar puncture is delayed and they already start antibiotics, sometimes that could sterilize your culture. And you might might not get a positive culture result. And therefore, the clinician will make the decision, the infectious disease specialist will make the decision, or the hospital staff will make the decision, well, this patient came in with symptoms that were very similar or very, it alarmed them to meningitis, so we're going to treat it as if it's meningitis. But normally, cultures in the lab should lead you to your diagnosis.
Now, what type of intervention or treatment did they attempt to, I guess?
With Lawson?
Mm-hmm.
They did immediately, eventually, I'll say, rather than immediately. But I would think about 2.5 to 3 hours after we got into the emergency room, they started her on an aggressive treatment for meningitis. They didn't have the culture back at that point, but they decided that, you know, they were so concerned about she just showed absolutely her symptoms were worsening, I guess is a
mm-hmm.
better, and she just
mm-hmm.
She couldn't move, and she was not responsive mm-hmm. to their questions or anything, so they just immediately went ahead and put her on the highest regimen to treat for the viral, bacterial, everything.
Mm-hmm. And you said she had been out of the country, so
mm-hmm.
did they have
she
to
had been in Europe.
Everyone, or how did they?
We did. We certainly contacted our daughter that she was visiting,
mm-hmm.
and they also gave a lot of us antibiotics. Just in case,
mm-hmm.
They have no idea. Her particular bacteria was pneumococcal, and they do not have any idea where it came from. Sometimes they can actually trace it,
right?
You know, if there's something, but they were not able to do that. And they said it very easily could have just been something that had been dormant in her body, could have been from the, you know,
mm-hmm.
her Starbucks trip that day,
right?
You know, just anything. They had absolutely no idea where it originated.
And how long does it take for it to manifest? I mean, you've got this, and you could just
very quickly.
Okay.
Meningitis, it comes on within hours.
Yeah.
You start having symptoms.
Okay.
By
so
the time
it's
you
not
go
something you could be walking around with and have for a long time.
No.
She had a dull headache, I would say, from about noon that afternoon.
Okay. But
and
still,
about 6:30 or 7 is when she said, you know, this is just, I think I have a migraine. So it was literally.
Yeah,
and of course she was
hours.
Exhausted, so she just thought it was exhausted.
True bacterial meningitis, you're not walking around for weeks or days.
Okay.
Not at all. But within hours, you're usually in the hospital.
Okay. Now, as far as treatment, are there, you always hear about alternative medicines. I mean, are there alternative, I guess, complementary medical practices that are recognized that are used with bacterial meningitis? Homeopathy, acupuncture, you know, you hear all this, and I want you, and I laugh in saying it, but I think it needs to be addressed because so many people will come up with, well, I've done this and I know how to do that, and I want you to really address this.
Yeah, not at all. With bacterial meningitis, you need antibiotics and you need it very quickly. They also use steroids to help, and it's a very, very strict protocol that there's no if, ands, or buts. For this type of, with bacteria, antibiotics treats bacteria.
Okay.
And if you don't get the antibiotic treatment, you will die from that infection.
So there's no diet, there's no vitamin regimen, there's no acupuncture.
No.
Okay. I just, you know. You know why I say that? Because there's
and
so
I mean,
many people.
Absolutely. And definitely for other things, those can fit.
Mm-hmm.
But for bacterial meningitis, they have 0% chance
And that also speaks back to the vaccination, how important that is. It's obviously not 100% because no vaccination is. There are other bacterial meningitis
strains
out there that it can't protect against, but it can protect against a whole lot of them.
Yes.
And it's very effective and very safe. Is that not correct? I think
that's exactly correct. So that's the main key in this, what we're trying to tell the community, get out to the community to preventive measures. It would be the vaccine and also to get to the hospital quickly and, you know, not to think you're not doing the right thing by bringing your child into the hospital.
But how prevalent, and even though I talked about the stats, okay, but how prevalent is it really? I mean,
it's rare.
Okay.
It's rare.
Yeah.
That's why the vaccination, I think, is so important and the booster information, because the fact that it is rare, you kind of want to, that's not going to happen to me.
Right.
And when it happens, it's just devastating.
Well, what's the prognosis? I mean, how many people survived this?
Well, it does have a fairly high enough mortality rate, anywhere from 16 to 20%. And that's sometimes a lot to do with timing of everything and the quicker you get them to the hospital on the medication. And even with very appropriate, very aggressive treatments, you can still die from this infection. So it is a very serious infection. And the main thing is it affects the young and affects the old. So therefore, it really, hits the family very hard when you have a 2-year-old or a toddler. Mm-hmm. And then when you have someone just embarking in the best part of life, going into college, and for them to pass from this infection. And if you have a grandmother who's been healthy, normally walkie-talkie, doing well, living, and then have meningitis. Because it can happen to healthy individuals. So therefore, it is very devastating to family, no matter the age, and it hits all age groups. So that's why it's so important.
So it doesn't matter about gender, none of that.
It has a blindfold when it comes to patients.
Okay, all right. And prognostically, those who survive, do they have any residuals?
Well, that's what. Yes, they have they can have some consequences, brain neurological consequences, some residual effects, and sometimes they don't. If they can survive it with medication and do well, but a lot of patients, as stated before, hearing loss, they can have some blindness, they can have stroke-like symptoms,
amputations,
and also not waking up.
Yeah,
not waking up from being in the coma or from this infection. So even if you survive it, you can have some devastating effects.
Okay. All right. And tell me about the run again.
Let's talk about it.
Get all
Saturday,
the details.
Saturday, September 28th on Fleischman Road on the athletic fields of Holy Comforter Episcopal School. The run actually starts on the athletic field, and then it goes into the adjoining property of Wolani Plantation, and it is gorgeous. Mm. It is just pristine. It's out. You're just in beautiful wooded land and pastures, and it's gorgeous. And the course is mowed very, very closely, and it's in great shape. It's a cross-country course. The run is chip-timed, so you don't have to be at the front to win. You're timed as you cross when you start and as you cross the finish line. We have a 5 and a 10K. Both of those will start together. It's a looped course for runners out there. And it will start at 8:30. The fun 1-mile walk starts at 8 o'clock. Registration can go online. You can go to runforlawson.org and register. You can also print a registration form and mail it in, and you can also sign up from 4 to 7 at Gold's Gym on Thursday and Friday afternoon, the 26th and 27th, and it's the Gold's Gym on Capitol Circle Northeast. You can sign up then. You can also sign up the morning of the run, and we'll be open at 7 o'clock to take registration. So we would just love for any and all to come out there. The other thing I'm going to say again is that we are awarding the top 3 participating high school or middle schools this year. We're trying to get the young people to come out. we'll make sure they have to have a little bit of awareness about meningitis. We'll have information out there, but we want them to come out. We're awarding the top participating schools $2,000, $1,000, and $500 for the first, second, and third numbers. So that also applies to the faculties of the schools. So we've got a lot of posters out. We've got billboards out. Leon County Schools allowed us to give them a lot of information before school started that they passed out to their PE teachers. And so the information should be in the school. And the foundation is also providing information to the wellness champions in each of our schools, our middle and high schools, about bacterial meningitis and its symptoms and its the vaccines and all that good information. So that we've also provided, and they have a meeting on the 25th of this month.
Now, if anyone wants to find out some more information as far as resources or even contribute to your foundation, what do they do?
That's wonderful. Yes. We would love it. Yes. Again, you can visit our website on runforlawson.org, www.runforlawson.org, and we've got all the information on that. It's got links to the CDC. It's got links to the National Meningitis Association, which I have just been very pleased with their efforts on education and awareness.
Yes.
And everything they do is approved by the CDC. So all their information is accurate and it's up to date and it's the best and about meningitis. And they primarily speak to meningococcal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But they're a great organization, and we support them. But we're also trying to really be active in our local schools and give them a lot of information and just get as much info out there as we can.
Well, it's always a delight to have you.
Thank you so much for allowing us
and
to be here.
And Dr. Funny, I want to say thank you. Any closing comments you'd like to make sure that you emphasize on meningitis before we close?
Well, I just want to say we want everyone who is within that adolescent years between 11 and 18 to get vaccinated, those going into college who are yet to be vaccinated, to be vaccinated, and for parents who have young children to follow the recommendations of the vaccine by their age group that they land in. And really also just if you're not sure what's going on with your child or your loved one, it doesn't have to be, it's not only children, to bring them into the ER to be evaluated. It's better safe than sorry. You don't have to worry about do they think I don't know what's going on or maybe I can treat this at home. Don't second guess yourself. Go with your first gut and bring that loved one in to be evaluated. And I want to say thank you, and thank you for allowing us to share and educate the community about this very important disease.
Thank you. To my listening audience, tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. This edition of 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical engineer, Evan Rossi. Audio copies are available, and if you would like to participate in 411 Team or have topic suggestions, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. That's 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Team podcasts, log in wfsu.org.